At KPMG, we make the difference. It's not just something we say. It's what we do. Our professionals believe in the value of collaboration and the power of technology. We work closely with clients to uncover insights that illuminate opportunity, develop bold solutions that innovate industries, and create better outcomes driven by data. Brighter insights. Bolder solutions. Better outcomes. It's how our people make the difference, driving growth and value for our clients. KPMG. Make the difference.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Capehart. A Jewish man walks into a white nationalist meeting. What could possibly go wrong? For comedian Alex Edelman, this actually happened in 2018, and he's turned that unforgettable experience into a hit Broadway stand-up called Just For Us, that is now an HBO special debuting on April 6th. In this conversation, first recorded for Washington Post Live on April 3rd, Alex talks all about the special, how it came to be, how it became conversant with the times in the aftermath of October 7th, and why the death of his best friend and work partner, Adam, played a role in his decision to stop doing the Just For Us routine. But we also talked about the mechanics of comedy and why he says, instead of comedy about Jews, we should have comedy about what it means to be Jewish.
I feel like we have been sort of like ushered into this corner of like Jackie Mason, like, hey! And it's just not reflective of like Jews or Judaism, at least to me. So I don't like it very much. I respect Jackie Mason hugely. He's one of the greatest comics of the last century, but like comedy about what it means to be something is always more interesting to me than comedy about the something, because everyone can relate to the comedy about what it means to be X.
I've already seen the special. It's so funny. And the ending is, I'm not even going to give it away. It is just—
Don't, please don't.
No, I won't. So Just For Us has been off-Broadway, on-Broadway, part of a national tour, including a stop here in Washington. But for those of us who are unfamiliar with your show, give a brief summary.
Okay. So there's lots of jokes, but I went to this meeting of white nationalists in Queens, and eventually one of them's like, this is the show, and eventually one of them's like, sorry, but this guy's Jew, and I'm like, yeah, I'm a Jew, and that's the entire 90-minute special, pretty much summed up in one really short thing, and at the end, and watch to see if they murder me or not. But spoiler, they don't. But yeah, that's pretty much the gist of the special. But obviously, it's mostly jokes. It's full of jokes, and it weaves in and out of the story with things that I think are tangential but also related. And yeah, it's been this like tremendous blessing in my life, and it's produced by Mike Birbiglia, who's one of my comedy heroes, and all my other comedy heroes have come to see it. So it's like very, very cool.
On that point, I think the clip that we have that I was going to show later, but let's show it now. This is, I think in this clip, you're trying to keep a low profile at this white nationalist meeting. Let's show that.
I feel someone kind of like lurking in my periphery. Like I'm being haunted. And when I turn around, there's this guy standing there. And this guy's sizing me up with a look on his face that I would honestly most accurately describe as... This is a Jew! Like, I'm pretty sure this is a Jew. And he said to me, hey, can I help you? As if I was gonna be like, yes! Well, I was on my way to synagogue for Yom Kippur, but I got lost and I stumbled in here. Do you know if these muffins is kosher?
So Alex, take me back to that moment in 2018 where this guy is scoping you out. What was going through your mind?
I mean, I don't remember. I honestly don't. I think that there wasn't a lot of fear. I think there's a lot of My friend Benj says that I'm the weirdest mixture of fearful and fearless that he's ever met. But I don't think there was a lot of fear. But there was only one moment in the meeting where things got like a little dicey. And I was like, I should probably probably go and not argue. But yeah, I hate to give such a I hate to give such a boring answer. But look, the show is full of the show is full of like little moments that I think highlight this little thing where like I'm very much of this group, but also not of this group.
Mm-hmm. In an interview with the Daily Northwestern in February, you said you dislike how diverse approaches to Jewish comedy have been stifled in favor of shtick comedy, adding, quote, instead of comedy about Jews, we should have comedy about what it means to be Jewish. Talk more about that.
I think that that's the most relatable. I don't know. I think that, wow, I never thought that a quote that I gave to a college newspaper in February would be read back to me. But yes, that is exactly how I feel about Jewish comedy. I feel like we have been sort of like ushered into this corner of like Jackie Mason, like, hey! And it's just not reflective of like Jews or Judaism, at least to me. So I don't like it very much. I respect Jackie Mason hugely. He's one of the greatest comics of the last century, but like comedy about what it means to be something is always more interesting to me than comedy about the something, because everyone can relate to the comedy about what it means to be X or what it means to want to be. So like writing students are often given the advice, like write what you know, right? Jonathan, you've heard that quote,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
People say write what you know. But you know, people misdiagnose that. Like I think that when people say write what you know, they don't mean like if you are a farmer, write a story about a farmer. Like what they mean is if you know longing, write longing. If you know embarrassment, write embarrassment. If you know a desperation to belong, write a desperation to belong. Because like otherwise you're not going to end up with Game of Thrones because no one's a dragon, right? No one's going to be like, here's my story about you being a dragon. Like you need people need to write the sort of like within them in terms of like hoping to reach a huge amount of people and in hopes of like writing about something specific in a way that's universal. Does that make sense? Or is
yeah,
that like
yes,
a very
that
boring
makes sense.
Technical
and
answer?
No. And that actually segues nicely into the next question I was going to ask you, because your comedy explores Jewish identity. And in the special, although you poke fun at your very Jewish full name and your upbringing, you share feelings of not being or feeling Jewish enough. Talk about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, everyone has that, right? Like my friends who are Greek, some of them are like, oh, I wish I was more Greek. That's what made me think of the joke. I have a friend who's Greek and he said, you know, oh, I don't feel Greek enough. And I thought, you're like the most Greek person I know. Like you feel very Greek to me. It's all Greek to me. But then I realized that the way that Nick sees me is the same, but for Judaism. And so and so I say that to my friends, I'm the most Jewish person they've ever met. But to my family, I'm Lady Gaga. Or to my family, I'm Episcopalian. Depends on the I change the joke up sometimes. But I feel like, although I assume that everybody feels that, right? Like anyone more religious than you is practically like a fundamentalist, practically the Taliban. Anyone less religious than you is barely religious. It's barely the religion. It's barely the group. And so, I think that that's a common feeling for most, but maybe I'm wrong there.
Oh no. Let me tell you that there's a whole, for me, I come at it, especially, you know, when it comes to being Black, you know, there are a whole cadre of people who are willing to stamp others as not being Black enough. And I've been hit with that stamp so many times, I'm fully covered. But I want to explore something else. Back in 2022, you told the Post, quote, I'm doing a show that is by its nature a little bit elusive. I wanted that to be the exercise. Explain that.
I think that entertainers don't have mystique anymore. Like it used to be that there was like a little element of, I think there was a little bit of guesswork. And I think especially in 2022, when I said that, I feel it slightly less now, but maybe it's just because I'm used to the feeling. We're in a sort of confessional arms race. And all my favorite jokes are jokes where audiences do some of the work. All my favorite jokes are jokes where someone said the most technically perfect joke in the English language was, other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? Because the audience provides the necessary step for each word, right? Mm-hmm. Or each clause. And so I felt like I wanted to leave some things deliberately ambiguous in the show so that it would prompt conversation and thoughts and more engagement with the work. And I have, I mean, I've left, I pose a lot of questions that I think I don't give answers to because there are so many answers or no answer. And I think that that's one of the reasons the show has found resonance with people, and that it's a thing that's like more like a coloring book than, you know, like a picture book. No.
No, that is a great image, because as I was watching the special, and I love comedians who make me work for the joke or make me work with them as they're telling the stories. And watching you, I was reminded of why I like Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle, and comedians like that, because they really make you. They're weaving a story. They're telling a story. You're being brought back and forth. So I totally get that. Alex, you've also said, quote, the discussion around anti-Semitism is exhausting. But people have told you how timely the show has been, the show it is since 2018, in part because of the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue had happened around then. Recently, you announced the end of performing Just for Us. What led to that decision?
I mean, partially it's time. Partially it's just like time to stop and try to move on and see if I can. Thankfully, this work has had so much resonance. And look, it started in like a tiny pub in London, and it went to this place that I never dreamed it would ever get to. But also, you know, I have said to people that I said to someone that the show was wrenching, and they and that got printed. But frankly, what I meant was, it's not the anti-Semitism part that has been the wrenching part. It's you know, I wrote the show with my with the sort of careful guidance of one of my closest friends, a guy named Adam Brace. Adam was my director. We worked together in 3 shows over 11 years, and pardon me. And everything I did long form I've done with Adam, and Adam passed away about 11 months ago, and the show without him. Oh, no, that's fine. Doing the show without him has been, it's been, I'd say not ideal, in the sense that, you know, in some ways the show, I think, is a sort of conversation with him. He was sort of my like smartest, funniest friend. And so I think good comedians always write for their smartest, funniest friend. I always sort of wrote for Adam. And I frankly, maybe this is a bit too personal for Washington Post Live, but
No, come on.
I mean, I sort of felt like if I would do the show enough that, and maybe this is the part of me, the religious part that that secular life can't completely stamp out. There's part of me that thought that maybe if I kept doing the show, that sort of Adam would sort of like speak to me. Mm-hmm. And well, the window is closed, but yeah, also 11 months is how long you say Kaddish for, which is in the Jewish faith, how long you, and so after a while, just sort of being in this conversation, being in this, I use the word relationship pretty loosely here, but relationship with my friend who is no longer here, that became a lot. Mm-hmm. And the timeliness of it, I guess October 7th is a bit of a horse of a different color and the resultant war in Gaza. And I actually felt happiest in the last 6 months whilst I was doing the show. because it was the show to me felt conversant with the moment, but also sort of an escape from it, if that makes any kind of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt very comforted, but after a while, just felt like it was time to move on. And I've always been suspicious of easy comforts. And so, it just felt like that because of all of these factors together, sort of felt like the right time. Sorry to give such a long and messy answer, but you know.
No apology needed, and not long, not messy. And I would say that you can still call it a relationship, because relationships are ones, especially really good ones, are ones that pay dividends even after they've ended, even after the person is gone. Do you think you've ended the show, but without your smartest and best friend, do you feel that you can still do comedy, that you can still write? Will you still be writing for him?
I don't know if I sure hope so. Like, sometimes people are like, he's with you, but it feels like people assume that sort of like AI idea, where it's just like, oh yes, the aggregate of all of his ideas will now form a thing that can be transferred into, you know, new situations. So I don't know. My guess is I have many smart, lovely friends who have sort of stepped into the breach here. And I've had, by the way, brilliant collaborators who, when Adam died, the only person we could think of sort of taking on was Alex Timbers, who is had a lot of experience doing comedy and a lot of experience doing Broadway. There's no one else who has the same level of experience crossover-wise that he does. And he sort of elevated the show while still sort of preserving the things that Adam and I had worked on, which I think is an impossible task. He'll never get enough credit for. But I have other collaborators who I think maybe could help, but also maybe I'll be a different comedian and maybe that's okay. Or maybe that's just like, is what it is. But I'm going back on the road. I'm doing new material in Providence, Rhode Island next week. I'm doing new material in Bloomington, Indiana the week after that. I'm doing a new show, or I'll do an hour of non-Just For Us material at Netflix as a Joke Festival on May 11th. I'm like pushing myself up to the table, even though I don't, if I'm being honest, necessarily feel entirely hungry. So, I'll get there. And I've got my first set tonight in Philadelphia, opening for a band. So I'm first set back after Just For Us. So I'm trying really hard to sort of get back into the swing of things and reconnect to my roots, even in the sort of like high pressure time.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
I want to get back to another thing you mentioned in your previous answer, and that was about the impact of October 7th on your comedy. And I want to bring it up because we have a question from Wendy Sabin from New Jersey. And Wendy asks, how has your comedy changed since October 7th?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult for me because I'm extremely, I have extremely unpopular opinions, Wendy. You know, I'm extremely anti-Israel, but extremely pro-Netanyahu, which is very, I'm joking. honestly, I've leaned on comedy so much more. Like, You know, I read a paper when I was in college, an academic paper, and gosh, I wish I could find it. I looked for it so much about how Holocaust survivors joked about the Holocaust in the 60s and 70s. Because we think of Holocaust survivors as extremely aged, because by the time we sort of arrived on the scene, they were already, you know, middle-aged or elderly. I say we meaning millennials. You know, I'm not speaking for folks who are older than myself. But when Holocaust survivors were in their 20s and 30s, they were dealing with this trauma in a way that was really profound, and humor was a big part of it. And I mean, imagine seeing the producers in the 60s. Imagine seeing Springtime for Hitler as a 35-year-old Holocaust survivor. Really different aspect, but it was it meant something special to them then. And so I've always thought of comedy as sort of a high wire, high risk act at its best, a comedy that can address, you know, a thing in a way that's oblique, but still, I guess, authentic in terms of understanding its heft, and also provide a little bit of relief, I think, is the sort of like holiest mission of comedy. And not all jokes can be that. Not all jokes should be that. But after October 7th, I think I've felt much more the cathartic potential of comedy. Mm-hmm. And audience members have told me that they have felt it much more, which has been like, it's been really nice. And I feel really keenly and gratefully when people, because I stand outside after every show and anyone who has a question, I answer. So, you know, that's,
you know, what you just said about putting into context, you know, the jokes about the Holocaust, particularly Springtime for Hitler, which I remember seeing, but not fully appreciating just the timing of when that hit compared to just relatively how recently the Holocaust had happened. You're giving me more work to do. So I am very happy to hear that you are getting back into it after Just for Us. I want to bring you back to London when you were just starting out, and it's there where you found your comedic voice during your college years. What did you need to tap into to find your style?
You know, that's such a good question. Gosh. Okay. Well, I was always a fan of club comedy, like nightclub comedy, like stuff I'd see at the Comedy Cellar on McDougal Street, where I, or stuff that I sort of encountered growing up in Boston, the Comedy Connection. And I always loved the sort of nightclub acts that I saw, like Sarah Silverman and Bob Saget and Chappelle and a guy named Greg Giraldo and Gary Gulman and Mike Birbiglia, like countless comedy. Like I loved Comedy Central comedy. Then I did my last semester of NYU in London, and I sort of got lucky in where I was and when I was. Like there was a movement of sort of more theatrical solo show comedy that was coming out of the UK, like James A. Kester and Josie Long and Stuart Lee. And these names probably won't mean much to people who are American who are listening to this, but it really, the synthesis of those two things. Oh, Phoebe Waller-Bridge is a name that you'll know. Phoebe was doing Fleabag, was just starting Fleabag, and we met at a bar in Soho and down the street from this one theater called the Soho Theater, where all my new work starts and all my favorite things happen. And it was at that theater in these like 5 square blocks of Soho where I sort of found the theater version of comedy to sort of fuse with the nightclub version of comedy that I had incubated in New York and Boston. So finding a more long form aesthetic for my comedy content made like sort of pushed me a little into that blend that I love. And yeah, I think that synthesis is what helped me find my voice.
Well, I asked you that question because in the New York Times, this is last year, June of 2023, I'm reading, you know, you describe your early influences as not great, explaining that quote, if I'm being honest, I saw a lot of racist comedy, self-congratulatory and smug. And it goes on to say that a one key turning point was when the British comic Josie Long took you aside. Josie Long took you aside and said, quote, what you're doing is getting laughs, but it's not who you are. How did that hit you when you heard that?
Relieved. I'm so relieved because I think every great note that you get tells you a thing you already knew deep down, but needed permission to understand or permission to see. My comedy was like a little more bully-ish or a little more like hard-edged than it needed to be. And I still have some of that like zetsiness. Like I still have some of this sort of like punchiness that gives a little bit of zing to a punchline, but I don't know. I just didn't really like the comedian that I was. It was still sort of a juvenile comedian. I think Josie Long sort of gave me permission to be a bit more of a mature one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's huge for a young comedian. That permission is really, really big. And getting that from Josie, who, by the way, I still sort of consider a big sister, even though Josie lives in Glasgow and I haven't seen her in such a long time and she has children. She's still one of the finest comedians in the Anglophone world and writes short stories and directs films and is such a role model. I think your role models, it's good to have the big, like grandfather type, like Mel Brooks, Jerry Seinfeld, Monty Pythons, but to have the people that are just a few years older than you or your age who you look up to, like I look up to like Bo Burnham. I look up to, I look up to Josie. I look up to Birbiglia. I look up to John Mulaney. Like these are all comedians who are around my age or a little bit older. Like those influences, like I think the most important thing a young comic can have is high standards. Because if he aims for them or she aims for them or they aim for them, they'll hit those standards. I think it's really important.
I'm glad you mentioned John Mulaney, because that's also a comedian I thought of while watching you. And I, in a Washington Post profile of you from 22, you talk about advice you get from people or you go to comedians and after a show and you ask them to give you one note on your routine. And one, I believe this is, Billy Crystal told you to get rid of the handheld mic and start using a headset. And the other thing I noticed that when you got rid of the handheld mic, you don't just stand in one place. Like you get your steps in Just For Us. I mean, I was winded by the time the special was over because you ran laps around the stage. So what are some of the best notes you've received thus far?
Well, Stephen Colbert encouraged me to find more stillness on stage, which I assume I still have work to do with. No, that's kidding. But he did. Although if you think about it, my favorite moments of the special are so many. There's a heavy pause in the special. There's a 26-second pause in this comedy special. And it's the most, to me, it's the most riveting moment of the special. So, I mean, I did try to take that advice. Although, by the way, I usually need to hear a really good note two or three times from two or three smart people before I... So, like, I got that note from Colbert, but I really got it from Alex Timbers, who, like, showed me where to put it and how to get it there. Steve Martin gave me a joke, like a one-liner, which is, like, one of my favorite one-liners in the show. I won't say which one because it needs a lot of context and it needed to be adjusted, but it was, like... Seinfeld told me not to address. Seinfeld gave me a note about something that got a laugh, but was, but takes the audience slightly out of the show. And that's another thing where it's like, you want your, whenever your comedy hero gives you a note, it sort of lets you breathe a little bit. It sort of lets you like, because usually it's a masterclass note. It's a note that only someone who has done it a lot would give to someone else who's doing it. And you know that something's wrong, but you can't quite identify it. And you're trained to get laughs. And usually, by the way, the greatest notes are the ones that take some laughs away, which sounds really counterintuitive because you're aiming to go for the laugh, but aiming for a more high quality laugh, aiming for a laugh that's a little bit more fulsome. Those are the best notes. So Jerry's note, Jerry, like he's my neighbor, but you know, the guy who played Jerry on Seinfeld, but yeah, I mean, like, so Jerry's notes, Billy's notes, Billy's note was huge. So,
mm-hmm. Well, but on Jerry's note, he said, which I thought was interesting, I instructed you on the art of not ruining a good joke by acknowledging the audience's response.
That's what he said. He said, acknowledging the response takes the audience out of the show. And he was so right, because acknowledging the response, sometimes you build comedy, not to get too crafty here, but comedy, it can be about building tension and then relieving it. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes you build the tension, but you haven't found the right like faucet to turn to release the tension, like the outlet for your outlet line isn't there. And sometimes acknowledging the response that an audience has given you is that outlet, but it's not a real one. It sort of takes the audience out of the show. So that's very technical and very small. But if you look after like a million technical things in your show, all of a sudden you have a really good show, right? What separates a really good show from a really great show can be these like tiny little masterclass things. And so like, yeah, Jerry doing that. I mean, Billy's note was a big one. Like moving from a handheld to a headset is such a huge aesthetic change. But he said it'll open up your show. It'll just make it better. It'll make it funnier. You'll have a million more new choices. And I had to pull this note out of him. He was very reluctant to be seen. He's very humble, Billy Crystal, and was very reluctant to be seen as being pushy. But not only did he give the note, he very kindly came back to check it out in action. So Billy saw the show twice, and he saw it. He saw it the night we filmed it on Broadway. So that was
wow.
It was the most special full circle moment for this guy, because the first solo show I saw was 700 Sundays. He came to Boston in 2005 or 2006. I was like 16. I'm going to go see it. I waited for him at the stage door afterward. Like I didn't have a word with him, but like he signed my program or something. And so to have that guy at the taping of my special is like, it's such a full circle, beautiful moment. It was wonderful.
Did you know he was there?
I knew he was there.
On stage?
I knew he was there. He let me know he was going to come. I was like, Billy, just so you know, it's taping that night. He was like, that's fine. He didn't want to be on camera. He really is he's a movie star and he's humble. Like, you know, come on. It's I have had so many like Eric Idle. I haven't told anyone this yet, but Eric Idle came to our last show in LA for Monty Python. So like,
wow,
what? Like what's happening? It's really and he was so effusive. These comedy guys are so much more humble than you think for the most part. It's really kind of cool.
Alex, we've already gone over, but I have to ask you one more question about the craft. One thing, and it's because you said Billy Crystal didn't want to be on camera, that made me remember this. It was something else I noticed, in addition to your footwork on stage. You very rarely saw the audience. In other comedy specials, you see laugh reactions and things, but the camera stays on you, either full close-up or just of you on stage. But I don't remember seeing any reactions from any audience members. Clearly that was intentional.
Very intentional. Alex Timbers did the most incredible job of the special. It looks amazing. We made decisions. We made huge decisions based on how the special would look. And we didn't want the special to be distracting. We wanted the special to be focused. We wanted the special to feel like a movie, because it's a narrative. Mm-hmm. And like, we wanted people to sort of be in the story. I also wanted to do a special that I haven't said this to anyone yet, but I wanted the special to have a little bit of like suspense. Like people, there need to be jokes. The jokes need to be so funny. And we cut everything that wasn't, but we also, it needs to have the oomph of a show that really makes you feel like you're gripped in the story. And Alex made a bunch of these really gorgeous, minimal, but intentional artistic choices that sometimes I forget until I see the shots. Like in the clip you showed, when I do the guy's face, there's a very subtle like zooming in on mine. That's not like a thing you ever see in a stand-up special. Like Alex, without being distracting, without being frenetic, really used this sort of like masterful brush to sort of keep the audience focused on the story. And it's enough to hold your attention in a very like short form, short attention world, because there are so many jokes that move so quickly on from each other. But at the same time, it's this one piece. And also, I don't like them. I don't like audience cutaways. If a joke is funny, I know. Like, I don't need to see somebody else laughing to tell me that the joke that I just saw was funny. Like, people at home are smart enough to know. People at home are, you know. And so, yeah, it was very intentional, but no one's ever asked me about it because no one's ever noticed yet. So it's very cool to be asked.
Ah. Alex Edelman, the name of your special. Well, is that a real Alex Katz behind you? Or is that
it's a not a real Alex Katz behind me. It's a print.
Okay.
I think I've got Alex Katz's. Also, this isn't even my apartment. I'm at a friend's apartment because there's construction outside of mine. So I went, and it's raining outside. So, but my friend can't afford a real Alex Katz. But that'd be really nice.
Well, I mean, but that's great. It's a great backdrop. Alex Edelman, the name of your HBO comedy special is called Just for Us, and it debuts on HBO. On April 6th. Thank you so much for coming to K-Part on Washington Post Live.
Guys, and thanks so much for watching this. And like, I really appreciate it. And Jonathan, these are fantastic questions. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to K-Part. It's edited by Nick Roberts. We'll have new episodes for you every Thursday. I'm Jonathan K-Part. You can find me on Twitter at KPartJ.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.